This week on the Allegheny Front, we're following the pipeline, the shale gas pipeline, that is. From finding methane leaks in natural gas infrastructure,
satellites can provide you with a detection. They can tell you, aha, you got a hot spot here.
To determining if the gas those pipelines are carrying is really being used for the public good.
You tell me anybody in this country that doesn't use plastics in some way and that plastics aren't critically important to their everyday lives.
And we'll hear from people whose lives are being impacted by natural gas storage.
There's no other water source, so, you know, what are people supposed to do?
I'm Kara Holsoppel. Join us for a special Allegheny Front. There are thousands of gas wells in the shale fields of Pennsylvania, Ohio, and West Virginia, and a growing number of pipelines moving that gas around the Northeast. This summer, we followed the pipeline with an in-depth look at what all this natural gas construction means for people and the environment. In our first story, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier tagged along with a team of scientists, trying to find out how much of this infrastructure is leaking methane, a potent greenhouse gas that contributes to climate change.
Actually a blue line with this green line, but you can't even see it anymore.
Naomi Zimmerman is checking a computer screen inside a white van that looks like it came straight from an episode of Storm Chasers. Zimmerman is leading a team of researchers from Carnegie Mellon University looking for methane here in the rolling hills of northeastern Pennsylvania. Computer monitors and expensive sensors are mounted inside the team's van, wind and weather probes on the outside. All told, there's $500,000 of equipment on the rig. To start her day, Zimmerman must first make sure the team's monitors are calibrated correctly. On a screen mounted to the dashboard, she reads off her levels.
So we're seeing readings of 0, 0.16, negative 0.1, /0.1, 1.4. That's approximately 0, good enough for...
With their rig checked out, the team is ready to roll. A few years ago, northeastern Pennsylvania was one of the hottest drilling spots in the country. Now, most of the rigs here are gone, but there are thousands of wells already drilled. And the hills and dairy farms around the region are crisscrossed with pipelines, compressor stations, and other infrastructure siphoning gas away from those wells. The team's first stop is about a half an hour away, next to a pipeline tucked onto the back edges of a local farm. They park their van and turn on the equipment. A minute later, scientists Asia Ellis and Mark O'Mara see a spike on the levels on their computer screen.
So we know that it's natural gas.
Wow.
It's quite a large leak. So,
that is
oh my
so
goodness.
Big, yeah.
Yeah, 3.2
ppm. That is super exciting.
It is exciting. And
the team is picking up about 1.2 parts per million of methane, or about 12 times the amount they would normally see coming off of a well pad. Then they see the levels go even higher.
Just went up to 9 ppm.
Wow.
Wow.
So this is a leaky pipeline right here.
These readings could help Zimmerman and other researchers answer what's become an important question: how much natural gas is leaking into the atmosphere? One of the benefits of natural gas is that when it burns, it produces far less carbon dioxide than coal, a fuel that gas is rapidly replacing as a source for electricity. So if you're burning gas instead of coal, that's good from a climate change perspective. But there's a rub. Methane is a powerful greenhouse gas, so...
If you're not burning the natural gas, and you're releasing sort of pure methane into the atmosphere, the methane has a much higher global warming potential than carbon dioxide on like sort of a 25-year timescale.
Zimmerman's colleagues at Carnegie Mellon have found the EPA has been underestimating methane leak rates for years, but they're still not sure exactly how much of it is escaping the country's oil and gas system. Why can't they figure this out? One reason is the sheer number of places where gas can escape. Mark Bowling is a vice president for Southwestern Energy, one of Pennsylvania's largest natural gas producers.
Unlike other areas like, say, power plant emissions of CO2 from power plants, we're not talking about one big facility that you have one stack and says, well, there's your source, it's coming out there.
Instead, each step of the natural gas network contains hundreds of places where gas can escape. Bowling's company cooperated with the Environmental Defense Fund on several studies to better understand methane pollution. He says spending money on equipment that can prevent methane leaks is good business for his company.
That methane that we can save from going up into the air and going into our pipeline, whatever we get for that will help defray the cost.
The EPA and several states, including Colorado and Pennsylvania, have begun implementing methane regulations on the oil and gas industry. Bowling resists these types of regulations because he says they prescribe equipment for companies to use that may not be necessary or effective.
You're basically telling them I have 100 different sources, 20 of them are the problem, but I want you to replace all 100.
He says it's better to let companies decide how to reduce their own emissions. And there's evidence that companies are starting to take methane pollution seriously.
1, 0, +1, +2, +3.
That's audio from a satellite launch in India this June. Aboard the rocket was a satellite called Claire, equipped with high-resolution methane sensors. Stéphane Germain is CEO of GHGSat, the Montreal-based company that launched the satellite. His clients include ExxonMobil and Shell. Germain says these companies can make money with this data because in Canada, they're already subject to a carbon pricing system.
Industrial operators would be financially motivated to better understand their emissions so that they can control them and ultimately reduce them, because really what they're doing at that point is reducing their own financial risk.
Using satellites to measure greenhouse gases is a technique NASA has used for years. But with improving sensors, they may become more important in the search for methane leaks. Daniel Jacob is a Harvard climate scientist who uses satellites to measure methane in the atmosphere above the United States. Jacob says satellites could be an early warning system to help on-the-ground teams find and fix leaks.
Satellites can provide you with a detection. They can tell you, aha, you got a hot spot here. And then once you figure out from space that you have a hot spot, then you can dispatch ground-based instruments or maybe, you know, low-flying aircraft to figure out where this methane is coming from.
Jacob's last paper used satellite data with a resolution of 10 square kilometers. His current project is using Claire, which has a resolution of just 50 meters. Claire is scheduled to start sending methane readings back to Earth this fall. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
There's a video of that high-tech Carnegie Mellon research van in action. That's at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. Remember this classic scene in the movie The Graduate with Dustin Hoffman?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, I am.
Plastics.
That movie came out nearly 50 years ago, but today some might also see a future in plastics. Just look at the 600 permanent jobs Shell says it will create with an ethane cracker it plans to build in Beaver County, near the Pennsylvania-Ohio border. It'll make ethane into plastics, and more of these plants are in the works for this region. That's because fuels like ethane, propane, and butane are abundant here. They're the byproducts of the natural gas that's being fracked, and they're part of the push to build new pipelines. Pipeline companies often get the power of eminent domain to take people's land for new lines, since natural gas is considered a public need. But the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports that some landowners are fighting back by saying products like ethane used to make plastic only benefit private companies.
The quiet hills of eastern Ohio have become a popular spot, and not just for cicadas, but for oil and gas development. Organic farmer Mick Luber says recent years have brought a compressor station and multiple well sites so close they wake him up at night.
For the first year that they were fracking, it was hard for me to go outside. I felt so bad hearing the roar of all this stuff. It's nice to have the cicadas that drown them out.
Then pipeline companies like Kinder Morgan came knocking on Luber's door.
They wanted to come right down through this main field and go up over top of that hill. There's a spring right up there. That's the most fertile part of this farm.
Another company, Marathon, made a deal with Luber's neighbor and is already building a pipeline on the southern border of his 65-acre farm. Shell is also planning a line here, so when Kinder Morgan showed up, Luber said no, no pipeline, not even a survey.
I told him I didn't want it.
Kinder Morgan sued. One of the main arguments in Luber's defense, the contents of Kinder Morgan's pipeline. Not natural gas for home heating, but ethane to make plastics for the Canadian company Nova Chemicals. Ethane, along with propane and butane, are known as natural gas liquids. They're byproducts of natural gas that's being fracked in the region. Increasingly, landowners are arguing that they shouldn't have to give up their property rights for companies to transport these liquids to make plastics, especially if they're being sent to other countries. Kinder Morgan spokesperson Alan Foer says, yes, they should. Plastics are in the public interest.
You tell me anybody in this country that doesn't use plastics in some way and that plastics aren't critically important to their everyday lives, from cups to medical devices to automobiles.
If this were a natural gas pipeline, the federal government would have authority over siting its route. But when it comes to natural gas liquids, that's being decided in state courts. In Kentucky, landowners recently won a victory when a court said a pipeline company couldn't take their property for a natural gas liquids pipeline. But in July, in Pennsylvania, an appellate court agreed with Sunoco, supporting its power to take land in all 17 counties along the path of a controversial pipeline. In an email, Sunoco said, it's come to agreement with the majority of landowners. At least one landowner in Harrison County, Ohio, where Sunoco's pipeline begins, is fighting the company's eminent domain action. Nicholas Anderson is the landowner's lawyer.
The bottom line is that when they're approaching landowners in Ohio, they have this big stick called eminent domain. And so they say, look, we'll give you X number of dollars per linear foot, but if you don't accept that, we're just going to take your property. And that is where we have a problem.
Anderson's Ohio clients lost their court case against Sunoco, but they're appealing. He says that Kinder Morgan, the company farmer Mick Luber was fighting, recently filed 130 eminent domain cases to take land for their ethane pipeline in at least 8 Ohio counties. Kinder Morgan spokesperson Alan Foer says they only take eminent domain action as a last resort.
If you look at our route, you can see a lot of zigs and zags and turns, certainly not a straight line. Those are all based upon big issues like avoiding environmentally sensitive areas or individual landowner concerns.
Like Mick Luber's. Kinder Morgan recently announced they would reroute around his farm. Still, Luber doesn't see it as a victory.
Well, as long as these guys are still doing this stuff, what is the victory, you know? You can't stop the vigilance, you know? People got to keep standing in their way.
Kinder Morgan says Luber got what he wanted, but the company wants to make it clear they can't reroute for every landowner who has a problem with their pipeline. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
Check out our website for a video of one family who tried to fight a pipeline and what their loss means for their generations-old homestead. That's at AlleghenyFront.org. As we followed the pipeline this summer, we met a lot of people who have a stake in how the shale gas industry develops.
My name is Lou Damiani. I'm co-owner of Damiani Wine Cellars here on beautiful Seneca Lake.
Later on the Allegheny Front, find out what a New York lake, natural gas storage, and wine have in common. This story would pair well with a nice, bold red. Stay tuned. Hundreds of miles of new pipelines are in the works to transport natural gas from the Marcellus and Utica shale formations. That's opened a new front in the battle over fracking, compressor stations. Joanna Richards explains that people near these facilities are reporting health problems.
300 people crowded into a school gym in Medina County, Ohio in February to lob questions, concerns, and some unvarnished anger at state environmental regulators.
Building this compressor station so close to people's homes speaks of greed over safety.
The Ohio EPA is not here on our side. We have to stand up.
The Ohio Environmental Protection Agency held this meeting as part of the permitting process for siting a compressor station along the planned Nexus pipeline. There are about 150 compressor stations in Ohio already, and state officials say there are about 15 new ones planned. Compressor stations are needed every 40 to 100 miles along pipelines to repressurize the gas and keep it moving. Like other industrial facilities, they are allowed to emit limited amounts of air pollutants. Ohio EPA and energy companies say the facilities are safe and well-regulated, but some people who live near them say the pollution is making them sick.
The dogs stick their nose to the door, turn around, and come right back in the house.
Barry Booth says his dogs gave him an early sign something was wrong with the air at his Carroll County home in eastern Ohio. In 2013, pipelines, wells, and compressor stations had sprouted up all around him. Booth, who's retired from manufacturing, didn't have a problem with this. He'd even signed a lease agreement with Chesapeake Energy to make some extra money. Then one day he went to get his wife, Mary Booth, a cup of coffee. He landed on the floor, nauseated and dizzy.
I jumped up to check on him and then ended up beside him. It was just really hard to breathe, and the odor was very strong.
The Booths say they started having rashes, nosebleeds, and headaches. Mary Booth battled aggressive breast cancer. The couple blames air emissions from the nearby gas facilities, especially a big compressor station. That facility's permit allows it to emit limited amounts of carbon monoxide, volatile organic compounds, and particulates, among other pollutants. There hasn't been a lot of research on the health impacts from oil and gas development, especially focused on just compressor stations. So how worried should people be? That's what Trevor Penning is trying to figure out. He leads the Center for Excellence in Environmental Toxicology at the University of Pennsylvania. Penning and some colleagues compared health trends in neighboring counties with and without heavy gas development. They analyzed all inpatient hospitalization records between 2007 and 2011, 92,000 records in all. Wayne County, without fracking, followed the national trend of declining hospital admissions. But in Susquehanna and Bradford counties, where gas extraction had taken off,
there was an increase in inpatient hospitalization rate, which comes out to be about 3% per year.
Penning says that's significant, and many of the health issues were things you'd expect from air pollution, like heart problems. His study didn't measure pollution levels or possible sources.
I actually feel that many residents who feel their health has been affected by this activity need to be listened to.
As more pipelines are built, more people outside drilling regions now find themselves near compressor stations too. That's why David Brown says it makes sense to try to single out these facilities for research. He's a public health toxicologist with the Southwest Pennsylvania Environmental Health Project, a research and advocacy group. It's funded in part by the Park Foundation, which also supports this reporting project. Brown heard complaints from people in the town of Minisink, New York. There was a compressor station there, but no other gas activity. He says the closest regional air sampling station, part of a federal monitoring network, showed pollution levels in compliance with federal standards. But when he did air monitoring in people's homes near the compressor station, particulate matter tested higher than the regional numbers. He also had residents keep health diaries, and Brown says there were problems.
When somebody's child wakes up with nosebleeds in the middle of the night regularly, then they know something is going wrong, although they're told that the child should be all right because the air standards aren't being violated.
Brown says the federal standards aim to improve overall regional air quality, but they're not designed to protect people from frequent close-range pollution exposure. Brown's research project was small, but he says his findings and others suggest compressor stations alone can be powerful polluters. Federal studies near two compressor stations in Pennsylvania found fine particulate matter and other pollutants at levels that could be harmful to people's health, although those studies, too, say their findings are limited. In Pennsylvania, regulators agree more data is needed. The state plans to install more air monitors in areas with compressor stations and gas wells next year. Some health advocates want more oversight of individual facilities, too. Right now, regulators rely mostly on companies' own emissions data. Mike Hopkins is with Ohio EPA's Division of Air Pollution Control.
It would be nice to be able to have an employee out at every single facility on a 24-hour basis to verify compliance. But the reality is that we can't afford to have that level of staffing.
And an industry spokesman says when it comes to compressor stations, activists are making a mountain out of a molehill. Jimmy Stewart is president of the Ohio Gas Association, a trade group.
Yes, there are some emissions from operating a compressor station. They pale in comparison to the emissions of a whole lot of other things that you are exposed to on a daily or weekly basis.
Stewart says people have less to fear from compressor stations than they do from traffic exhaust and gas station fumes.
So should we then shut down every Speedway and BP, and should we stop using gasoline and diesel fuel? I don't think so.
But Barry Booth, the man who lives near a compressor station in Carroll County, says he and his wife are so afraid for their health, after decades in this region, they're planning to move. A neighboring family settled a lawsuit with a company over a different compressor station. Now Booth, a former local union leader, is back to battling companies in retirement. In public meetings, he's urged people to fight new compressor stations.
That's what pisses me off. I would not be doing any of this. If the company would be doing what they're supposed to be doing to the environment and everything, I would be out smelling the roses. I would be getting my paycheck from the gas and oil industry and everything.
The country wants the homegrown energy and jobs from oil and gas development. But Trevor Penning, the UPenn public health researcher, says it comes with a cost.
The EPA always works on not the concept of no risk, but acceptable risk. So the issue becomes is what is the acceptable risk here?
Penning says there's a huge need for more information about compressor stations to clarify what the risks actually are. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Joanna Richards.
The Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection was supposed to have completed an air monitoring study on compressor stations by now. But the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette reported that study is 3 years behind schedule. That's due to the change in administrations, questions about methodology, and a lack of resources. We've been looking at issues related to pipelines, following natural gas and other fuels that are byproducts of fracking as they're transported from underground wells to our homes. When energy companies produce more than people need, they have to find a place to store it. There are over 400 underground storage facilities in the U.S., in places like old oil wells and depleted aquifers. And that's how some residents and businesses in the Finger Lakes region of New York got involved in a standoff over a plan to store natural gas and propane in a salt cavern near their drinking water. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant went to Seneca Lake to find out more.
Driving around Seneca Lake, evidence of industry is everywhere.
You have to try our rosé.
The wine industry, that is. There are fields upon fields of grapevines, with wineries and tasting rooms nestled along the lakeside, like this one.
My name is Lou Damiani. I'm co-owner of Damiani Wine Cellars here on beautiful Seneca Lake.
Damiani grew up around here. He and his partner started clearing land and planting grapes in the early 1990s.
And realized the revolution that was taking place here in the grapes we could grow and the wines we could produce.
In recent years, this has been named a top destination for wine lovers. Tourism is a $3 billion a year industry in the Finger Lakes. In addition to tasting and buying wine, many tourists also boat and fish on Seneca Lake, a deep and salty lake that supplies drinking water to 100,000 people. Looking out the tasting room window over the grapevines, Damiani points across the lake to the U.S. salt plant. He and others who work and live here worry about a plan under consideration by the New York Department of Environmental Conservation to store fuels in the salt caverns. This is the sound of salt being packaged and shipped out at the plant in Watkins Glen for pharmaceuticals, cleaning, and just regular table salt. Salt has been mined under Seneca Lake for over 100 years. The company that's now called Crestwood bought U.S. Salt in 2008. Crestwood declined an interview for this story, but they got me in touch with Mike Gilbert, the union worker at the plant.
I work in the shipping department. I've been here for about 15 years now.
I caught up with Gilbert around 8 a.m. during his second shift. He says to get the salt, they pump millions of gallons of water down thousands of feet into the caverns at high pressure. The salt dissolves in the water, and then they pump it back up.
Well, yeah, it's a brine. Brine is a liquid. It looks just like water. You wouldn't know unless you actually taste it that it's very salty.
The brine is stored in open ponds or pits. It's heated to evaporate the water. Crestwood wants to use the salt caverns to store fuels.
What they're proposing to do is put propane down in there.
The company already stores natural gas in some of the salt caverns and wants to expand that capacity. It also wants to store 1.5 million barrels of propane. Gilbert says the United Steelworkers support the project. Crestwood plans to add up to 17 full-time jobs.
We are Seneca Lake!
But a lot of people don't think it's worth the risk. More than 600 people have been arrested protesting Crestwood during the years its storage plans have been under consideration. They regularly stand at Crestwood's front gates. Anti-fracking activist David Braun of California recently joined them.
I am risking arrest with you all today because of disasters with gas storage that I have seen up close. Don't let it happen here.
The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has already approved the natural gas expansion project. The New York DEC has been considering the proposal for 7 years now. It found last year that opponents have not provided adequate proof to back up their concerns, although the DEC has not given final approvals to the Crestwood project. Meanwhile, the company has responded to community concerns by scaling back its proposal, eliminating plans to store 600,000 barrels of butane and reducing propane storage by nearly a third. It also dropped a controversial plan to bring in fuels by rail. But many local people are still worried about the project's impact on water quality.
Salmo Creek Vineyards, this is Tina.
Tina Haslett manages a vineyard here that's been in her husband's family since 1852.
There's no other water source, so, you know, what are people supposed to do?
But supporters of Crestwood's plans, including the Schuyler County Legislature, where all this is being debated, say the only holdup is politics. They're waiting for Governor Andrew Cuomo, who's already banned fracking in New York, to make a decision. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
Thanks for listening to this week's show. There are more stories in our Follow the Pipeline series at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. While you're there, check out a new feature, This Week Outside, a collection of some of the best photos that nature has to offer from our region, all from Instagram. You can find us on social media too. We're on Facebook and Twitter, at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds, the Laurel Foundation, the Catherine Mavis McKenna Foundation, PNC Charitable Trusts, and the Benedum Foundation. Our series Follow the Pipeline is funded by the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of energy and conservation.